Hi, it's me again, Lewis. We're back for part two of Jerusalem's Lot. This is where things start to get really weird and spooky. There is a bit longer than I thought it was, this second part. This might be a bumper, extra long episode. I really don't know yet. And I need you to do me a favor, actually, if you're listening to this. I'm recording this just before lunch, so if you hear my tummy rumble, pretend you don't hear that. Okay, thanks. Okay, without further ado, let's get into it. 17th of October, 1850. Dear gentlemen, in the most recent edition of your catalogue of household items, i.e. summer 1850, I noticed a preparation which is titled Rat's Bane. I should like to purchase one 5-pound tin of this preparation at your stated price of 30 cents. I enclose return postage. Please mail to Calvin McCann, Chapelway, to Preacher's Corners, Cumberland County, Maine. Thank you for your attention in this matter. I remain, dear gentlemen, Calvin McCann. 19th of October, 1850. Dear Bones, developments of a disquieting nature. The noises in the house have intensified, and I am growing more to the conclusion that rats are not all that move within our walls. Calvin and I went on another fruitless search for hidden crannies or passages, but found nothing. How poorly we would fit into one of Mrs. Radcliffe's romances! Cal claims, however, that much of the sound emanates from the cellar, and it is there we intend to explore tomorrow. It makes me no easier to know that Cousin Stephen's sister met her unfortunate end there. Her portrait, by the by, hangs in the upstairs gallery. Marcella Boone was a sadly pretty thing, if the artist got her right, and I do know she never married. At times I think that Mrs. Cloris was right, that this is a bad house. It has certainly held nothing but gloom for its past inhabitants. But I have more to say of the redoubtable Mrs. Cloris, for I have had this day a second interview with her. As the most level-headed person from the corners that I have met thus far, I sought her out this afternoon, after an unpleasant interview which I will relate. The wood was to have been delivered this morning, and when noon came and passed, and no wood with it, I decided to take my daily walk into the town itself. My object was to visit Thompson, the man with whom Cal did business. It has been a lovely day, full of the crisp snap of bright autumn, and by the time I reached the Thompsons' homestead, Cal, who remained home to poke further through Uncle Stephen's library, gave me adequate directions, I felt in the best mood that these last few days have seen, and quite prepared to forgive Thompson's tardiness with the wood. The place was a massive tangle of weeds and fallen down buildings in need of paint. To the left of the barn, a huge sow, ready for November butchering, grunted and wallowed in a muddy sty, and in the littered yard between house and outbuildings, a woman in a tattered gingham dress was feeding chickens from her apron. When I hailed her, she turned a pale and vapid face towards me. The sudden change in expression from utter doltish emptiness to one of frenzied terror was quite wonderful to behold. I can only think she took me for Stephen himself, for she raised her hand in the prong-fingered sign of the devil eye and screamed. The chicken feed scattered on the ground, and the fowls fluttered away, squawking. Before I could utter a sound, a huge hulking figure of a man clad only in long-handled underwear lumbered out of the house with a squirrel rifle in one hand and a jug in the other. From the red light in his eye and the unsteady manner of walking, I judged that this was Thompson the woodcutter himself. "A boon!" he roared. "God damn your eyes!" Just out of Lewis. This is Lewis Brindley. This isn't written in the book. "God damn" is struck out as though the person writing the letter is a sort of a God-fearing man. He doesn't want to write "God damn" down, so it's G sort of dash D dash N. So yeah. He dropped the jugger rolling and also made the sign. "I've come," I said, with as much equanimity as I could muster under the circumstances, "because the wood has not. According to the agreement you struck with my man..." "God damn your man too," said... This is the striking out continues. "God damn your man too," I say. And for the first time I noticed that beneath his bluff and bluster, he was deadly afraid. I began seriously to wonder if he mightn't actually use his rifle against me in his excitement. I began carefully. "As a gesture of courtesy, you might..." "God damn your courtesy!" "Very well, then," I said with as much dignity as I could muster. "I bid you good day, until you are more in control of yourself." And with this, I turned away and began down the road to the village. "Don't you come back," he screamed after me. "Stick with your evil up there! Cursed! Cursed! Cursed!" He pelted a stone at me, which struck my shoulder. I would not give him the satisfaction of dodging. So I sought out Mrs. Cloris, determined to solve the mystery of Thompson's enmity at least. She is a widow, and none of your confounded matchmaking, Bones. She is easily 15 years my senior, and I'll not see 40 again. and lives by herself in a charming little cottage at the ocean's very doorstep. I found the lady hanging out her wash, and she seemed genuinely pleased to see me. I found this a great relief. It is vexing almost beyond words to be branded pariah for no understandable reason. "Mr. Boone," said she, offering a heart curtsy, "if you come about washing, I take none in past September. My rheumatiz pains me so that it's trouble enough to do my own. I wish laundry was the subject of my visit. I've come for help, Mrs. Cloris. I must know all you can tell me about Chapelwaite and Jerusalem's Lot, and why the town folk regard me with such fear and suspicion." "Jerusalem's Lot? You know about that, then?" "Yes," I replied, "and I visited it with my companion a week ago." "God!" She went pale as milk and tottered. I put out a hand to steady her. Her eyes rolled horribly, and for a moment I was sure she would swoon. "Mrs. Cloris, I am sorry if I have said anything to—" "Come inside," she said. "You must know, sweet Jesu, the evil days have come again." She would not speak more until she had brewed strong tea in her sunshiny kitchen. When it was before her, she looked pensively out at the ocean for a time. Inevitably, her eyes and mine were drawn to the jutting brow of Chapelwaite Head, where the house looked out over the water. The large bay window glittered in the rays of the westering sun like a diamond. The view was beautiful, but strangely disturbing. She suddenly turned to me and declared vehemently, "Mr. Boone, you must leave Chapelwaite immediately." I was flabbergasted. "There has been an evil breath in the air since you took up residence. In the last week, since you set foot in the accursed place, there have been omens and portents. A call over the face of the moon, flocks of whippoorwills which roost in the cemeteries, an unnatural birth. You must leave." When I found my tongue, I spoke as gently as I could. "Mrs. Cloris, these things are dreams. You must know that." "Is it a dream that Barbara Brown gave birth to a child with no eyes? Or that Clifton Brockett found a flat, pressed trail 5 feet wide in the woods beyond Chapelwaite, where all had withered and gone white? And can you, who have visited Jerusalem's Lot, say with truth that nothing still lives there?" I could not answer. The scene in that hideous church sprang before my eyes. She clamped her gnarled hands together in an effort to calm herself. "I know of these things from my mother and her mother before her. Do you know the history of your family as it applies to Chapelwaite?" "Vaguely," I said. "The house has been the home of Philip Boone's line since the 1780s. His brother Robert, my grandfather, located in Massachusetts after an argument over stolen papers. Of Philip's side I know little, except that an unhappy shadow fell over it, extending from father to son to grandchildren. Marcella died in a tragic accident, and Stephen fell to his death. It was his wish that Chapelwaite become the home of me and mine, and that the family rift thus be mended." "Never to be mended," she whispered. "You know nothing of the original quarrel. Robert Boone was discovered rifling his brother's desk. Philip Boone was mad," she said. "A man who trafficked with the unholy. The thing which Robert Boone attempted to remove was a profane Bible written in the old tongues, Latin, Druidic, others, a hell book. De Vermis Mysteris." She recoiled as if struck. "You know of it?"
"I have seen it."
"Touched it?" It seemed again she might swoon. A hand went to her mouth as if to stifle an outcry. "Yes, in Jerusalem's Lot. On the pulpit of a corrupt and desecrated church." "Still there. Still there, then." She rocked in her chair. "I had hoped God in his wisdom had cast it into the pit of hell." "What relation had Philip Boone to Jerusalem's Lot?"
"Blood relation," she said darkly.
"The mark of the beast was on him, and although he walked in the clothes of the Lamb. And on the night of the 31st of October, 1789, Philip Boone disappeared, and the entire populace of that damned village with him." She would say little more, in fact, seemed to know little more. She would only reiterate her pleas that I leave, giving as reason something about blood calling to blood, and muttering about those who watch and those who guard. As twilight drew on, she seemed to grow more agitated rather than less, and to placate her I promised that her wishes would be taken under strong consideration. I walked home through lengthening, gloomy shadows, my good mood quite dissipated and my head spinning with questions which still plague me. Cal greeted me with the news that our noises in the walls have grown worse still, as I can attest at this moment. I try to tell myself that I hear only rats, but then I see the terrified, earnest face of Mrs. Cloris. The moon has risen over the sea, bloated, full, the colour of blood, staining the ocean with a noxious shade. My mind turns to that church again, and here a line is struck out. "But you shall not see that, Bones. It is too mad. It is time I slept, I think. My thoughts go out to you. Regards, Charles." The following is from the Pocket Journal of Calvin McCann. 20th of October, 1850. took the liberty this morning of forcing the lock which binds the book closed. Did it before Mr. Boone arose. No help. It is all in cipher. A simple one, I believe. Perhaps I may break it as easily as the lock. A diary, I am certain the hand oddly like Mr. Boone's own. Whose book, shelved in the most obscure corner of this library and locked across the pages? It seems old, but how to tell? The corrupting air has largely been kept from its pages. More later, if time. Mr. Boone set upon looking about the cellar. I'm afraid these dreadful goings-on will be too much for his chancy health yet. I must try to persuade him, but he comes. 20th of October, 1850. Bones, I can't write of this yet. I... From the pocket journal of Calvin McCann. 20th of October, 1850. As I had feared, his health has broken. Dear God, our Father, who art in heaven, cannot bear to think of it, yet it is planted, burned on my brain like a tintype, the horror in the cellar. Alone now, 8:30. House silent, but found him swooned over his writing table. He still sleeps. Yet for those few moments, how nobly he acquitted himself, while I stood paralyzed and shattered. His skin is waxy, cool. Not the fever again, God be thanked. I daren't move him or leave him to go to the village. And if I did go, who would return with me to aid him? Who would come to this cursed house? Oh, the cellar. The things in the cellar that have haunted our walls. 22nd of October, 1850. Dear Bones, I am myself again, although weak, after 36 hours of unconsciousness. Myself again. What a grim and bitter joke. I shall never be myself again. Never. I have come face to face with an insanity and horror beyond the limits of human expression, and the end is not yet. If it were not for Cal, I believe I should end my life this minute. He is one island of sanity in all this madness. You shall know it all. We had equipped ourselves with candles for our cellar exploration, and they threw a strong glow that was quite adequate. Hellishly adequate. Calvin tried to dissuade me, citing my recent illness, saying that the most we should probably find would be some healthy rats to mark for poisoning. I remained determined, however. Calvin fetched a sigh and answered, "Have it as you must, then, Mr. Boone. The entrance to the cellar is by means of a trap in the kitchen floor, which Cal assures me he has since stoutly boarded over, and we raised it only with a great deal of straining and lifting. A fetid, overpowering smell came up out of the darkness, not unlike that which pervaded the deserted town across the Royal River. The candle I held shed its glow on a steeply slanting flight of stairs leading down into darkness. They were in a terrible state of repair. In one place an entire riser missing, leaving only a black hole, and it was easy enough to see how the unfortunate Marcella might have come to her end there. "Be careful, Mr. Boone," Cal said. I told him I had no intention of being anything but, and we made the descent. The floor was earthen, the walls of stout granite, and hardly wet. The place did not look like a rat haven at all, for there were none of the things rats like to make their nests in, such as old boxes, discarded furniture, piles of paper, and the like. We lifted our candles, gaining a small circle of light, but still able to see little. The floor had a gradual slope which seemed to run beneath the main living room and the dining room, i.e. to the west. It was in this direction we walked. All was in utter silence. The stench in the air grew steadily stronger, and the dark about us seemed to press like wool, as if jealous of the light which had temporarily deposed it after so many years of undisputed dominion. At the far end, the granite walls gave way to a polished wood which seemed totally black and without reflective properties. Here the cellar ended, leaving what seemed to be an alcove off the main chamber. It was positioned at an angle which made inspection impossible without stepping around the corner. Calvin and I did so. It was as if a rotten spectre of this dwelling's sinister past had risen before us. A single chair stood in this alcove, and above it, fastened from a hook in one of the stout overhead beams, was a decayed noose of hemp. "Then it was here that he hung himself," Cal muttered. "God!" "Yes, with the corpse of his daughter lying at the foot of the stairs behind him." Cal began to speak. Then I saw his eyes jerked to a spot behind me. Then his words became a scream. "How, Bones, can I describe the sight which fell upon our eyes? How can I tell you of the hideous tenants within our walls?" The far wall swung back, and from that darkness a face leered, a face with eyes as ebon as the Styx itself. Its mouth yawned in a toothless, agonized grin. One yellow, rotted hand stretched itself out to us. It made a hideous, mewling sound and took a shambling step forward. The light from my candle fell upon it, and I saw the livid rope burn about its neck. From beyond it, something else moved, something I shall dream of until the day when all dreams cease. A girl with a pallid, mouldering face and a corpse grin, a girl whose head lolled at a lunatic angle. They wanted us, I know it. And I know they would have drawn us into that darkness and made us their own had I not thrown my candle directly at that thing in the partition and followed it with the chair beneath that noose. After that, all is confused darkness. My mind has drawn the curtain. I awoke, as I have said, in my room with Cal at my side. If I could leave, I should fly from this house of horror with my nightdress flapping at my heels, but I cannot. I have become a pawn in a deeper, darker drama. Do not ask how I know, I only do. Mrs. Cloris was right when she said she spoke of blood calling to blood. And how horribly right when she spoke of those who watch and those who guard. I fear that I have wakened a force which has slept in the tenebrous village of Salem's Lot for half a century. A force which has slain my ancestors and taken them in an unholy bondage as Nosferatu, the undead. And I have greater fears than these, Bones, but I still see only in part. If I knew at all. Charles. Postscriptum. And of course I write this only for myself. We are isolated from Preacher's Corner. I daren't carry my taint there to post this, and Calvin will not leave me. Perhaps, if God is good, this will reach you in some manner. See. From the Pocket Journal of Calvin McCann, 23rd of October, 1850. He is stronger today. We talked briefly of the apparitions in the cellar, and agreed they were neither hallucinations nor of an ectoplasmic origin, but real. Does Mr. Boone suspect, as I do, that they have gone? Perhaps. The noises are still, yet all is ominous, yet o'ercast with a dark pall. It seems we wait in the deceptive eye of the storm. I have found a packet of papers in an upstairs bedroom, lying in the bottom drawer of an old roll-top desk. Some correspondence and receipted bills lead me to believe the room was Robert Boone's. Yet the most interesting document is a few jottings on the back of an advertisement for gentlemen's beaver hats. At the top is writ, "Blessed are the meek." Below, the following apparent nonsense is writ. It's essentially just a long list of assorted letters. I'm not going to read it aloud, it would be very boring. "I believe 'tis the key of the locked and coded book in the library. The cipher above is certainly a rustic one used in the War for Independence, known as the fence rail. When one removes the nulls from the second bit of scribble, the following is obtained." It's a replicated piece of text, but with some of the letters removed. "Read up and down rather than across, and the result is the original quotation from the Beatitudes. Before I dare show this to Mr. Boone, I must be sure of the book's contents." 24th of October, 1850. "Dear Bones, an amazing occurrence. Cal, always closed-mouthed until absolutely sure of himself, a rare and admirable human trait, has found the diary of my grandfather Robert. The document was in a code which Cal himself has broken. He modestly declares that the discovery was an accident, but I suspect that perseverance and hard work had rather more to do with it. At any rate, what a sombre light it sheds on our mysteries here. The first entry is dated the 1st of June 1789, the last the 27th of October 1789, 4 days before the cataclysmic disappearance of which Mrs. Cloris spoke. It tells a tale of deepening obsession, nay, of madness, and makes hideously clear the relationship between Great Uncle Philip, the town of Jerusalem's Lot, and the book which rests in that desecrated church. The town itself, according to Robert Boone, predates Chapelwaite, built in 1782, and Preacher's Corners, known in those days as Preacher's Rest and founded in 1741. It was founded by a splinter group of the Puritan faith in 1710, a sect headed by a dour religious fanatic named James Boone. What a start that gave me! That this Boone bore a relation to my family can hardly be doubted, I believe. Mrs. Cloris could not have been more right in her superstitious belief that familial bloodline is of crucial importance in this matter, and I recall with terror her answer to my question about Philip and his relationship to Salem's Lot. Blood relation, said she, and I fear that it is so. The town became a settled community built around the church where Boone preached or held court. My grandfather intimates that he also held commerce with any number of ladies from the town, assuring them that this was God's way and will. As a result, the town became an anomaly, which could only have existed in those isolated and queer days when belief in witches and the virgin birth existed hand in hand, an interbred, rather degenerate religious village controlled by a half-mad preacher whose twin gospels were the Bible and De Gourges' sinister demon dwellings. A community in which rites of exorcism were held regularly, a community of incest and the insanity of physical defects which so often accompany that sin. I suspect, and believe Robert Boone must have also, that one of Boone's bastard offsprings must have left or have been spirited away from Jerusalem's lot to seek his fortune to the south, and thus founded our present lineage. I do know by my own family reckoning that our clan supposedly originated in that part of Massachusetts which has so lately become this sovereign state of Maine. My great-grandfather Kenneth Boone became a rich man as a result of the then flourishing fur trade. It was his money, increased by time and wise investment, which built this ancestral home long after his death in 1763. His sons, Philip and Robert, built Chapelwaite. Blood calls to blood, Mrs. Cloritz said. Could it be that Kenneth was born of James Boone, fled the madness of his father and his father's town, only to have his sons, all unknowing, build the Boone home not 2 miles from the Boone beginnings? If 'tis true, does it not seem that some huge and invisible hand has guided us? According to Robert's diary, James Boone was an ancient in 1789, and he must have been. Granting him an age of 25 in the year of the town's founding, he would have been 104, a prodigious age. The following is quoted direct from Robert Boone's diary. 4th of August, 1789. Today, for the first time, I met this man with whom my brother has been so unhealthily taken. I must admit this Boone controls a strange magnetism which upset me greatly. He is a veritable ancient, white-bearded and dresses in a black cassock which struck me as somehow obscene. More disturbing yet was the fact that he was surrounded by women as a sultan would be surrounded by his harem. And P assures me that he is active yet, although at least an octogenarian. The village itself I had visited only once before and will not visit again. Its streets are silent and filled with the fear the old man inspires from his pulpit. I fear also that like has mated with like, as so many of the faces are similar. It seemed that each way I turned I beheld the old man's visage. All are so wan, they seem lacklustre, as if sucked dry of all vitality. I beheld eyeless and noseless children, women who wept and gibbered and pointed at the sky for no reason, and garbled talk from the scriptures with talk of demons. P wished me to stay for services, but the thought of that sinister ancient in the pulpit before an audience of this town's interbred populace repulsed me, and I made an excuse. The entries preceding and following this tell of Philip's growing fascination with James Boone. On the 1st of September 1789, Philip was baptized into Boone's church. My brother says, "I am aghast with amaze and horror. My brother has changed before my very eyes. He even seems to grow to resemble the wretched man." First mention of the book occurs on 23rd of July. Robert's diary records it only briefly. Philip returned from the smaller village tonight with, I thought, a rather wild visage. Would not speak until bedtime, when he said that Boone had inquired after a book titled Mysteries of the Worm. To please P, I promised to write to Johns and Goodfellow a letter of inquiry. P almost fawningly grateful. On the 12th of August, this notation: received 2 letters in the post today, one from Johns and Goodfellow in Boston. They have note of the tome in which P has expressed an interest. Only 5 copies extant in this country. The letter is rather cool, odd indeed. Have known Henry Goodfellow for years. 13 August. P, insanely excited by Goodfellow's letter, refuses to say why. He would only say that Boone is exceedingly anxious to obtain a copy. Cannot think why. By the title it seems only a harmless gardening treatise. I'm worried for Philip. He grows stranger to me daily. I wish now that we had not returned to Chapelwaite. The summer is hot, oppressive, and filled with omens. There are only 2 further mentions of the infamous book in Robert's diary. He seems not to have realised the true importance of it, even at the end. From the entry of 4 September. I have petitioned Goodfellow to act as P's agent in the matter of the purchase, although my better judgment cries against it. What use to demur? Has he not his own money, should I refuse? And in return I have extracted a promise from Philip to recant this noisome baptism. Yet he is so hectic, nearly feverish. I do not trust him. I am hopelessly at sea in this matter. Finally, 16 September. The book arrived today, with a note from Goodfellow saying he wishes no more of my trade. P was excited to an unnatural degree, all but snatched the book from my hands. It is written in bastard Latin and a runic script of which I can read nothing. The thing seemed almost warm to the touch and to vibrate in my hands as if it contained a huge power. I reminded P of his promise to recant, and he only laughed in an ugly, crazed fashion and waved that book in my face, crying over and over again, "We have it! We have it! The worm! The secret of the worm!" He has now fled, I suppose to his mad benefactor, and I have not seen him more this day. Of the book there is no more, but I have made certain deductions which seem at least probable. First, that this book was, as Mrs. Cloris has said, the subject of the falling out between Robert and Philip. Second, that it is a repository of unholy incantation, possibly of druidic origin. Many of the druidic blood rituals were preserved in print by the Roman conquerors of Britain in the name of scholarship, and many of these infernal cookbooks are among the world's forbidden literature. Third, that Boone and Philip intended to use the book for their own ends. Perhaps, in some twisted way, they intended good, but I do not believe it. I believe they had long before bound themselves over to whatever faceless powers exist beyond the rim of the universe, powers which may exist beyond the very fabric of time. The last entries of Robert Boone's diary lent a dim glow of approbation to these speculations, and I allow them to speak for themselves. 26th of October, 1789. A terrific babble in preachers' corners today. Frawley the blacksmith seized my arm and demanded to know what your brother and that mad antichrist are into up there. Goody Randall claims there have been signs in the sky of a great impending disaster. A cow has been born with two heads. As for myself, I know not what impends. Perhaps 'tis my brother's insanity. His hair has gone grey almost overnight. His eyes are great bloodshot circles from which the pleasing light of sanity seems to have departed. He grins and whispers, and, for some reason of his own, has begun to haunt our cellar when not in Jerusalem's lot. The whippoorwills congregate about the house and upon the grass. Their combined calling from the mist blends with the sea into an unearthly shriek that precludes all thought of sleep. 27th of October, 1789. Followed P this evening when he departed for Jerusalem's lot, keeping a safe distance to avoid discovery. The cursed whippoorwills flock through the woods, filling all with a deathly psychopompotic chant. I dared not cross the bridge. The town all dark except for the church, which was lit in with a ghastly red glare that seemed to transform the high peaked windows into the eyes of the inferno. Voices rose and fell in a devil's litany, sometimes laughing, sometimes sobbing. The very ground seemed to swell and groan beneath me, as if it bore an awful weight, and I fled, amazed and full of terror, the hellish screaming cries of the whippoorwills dinning my ears as I ran through those shadow-riven woods. All tends to the climax, yet unforeseen. I dare not sleep for the dreams that come, yet not remain awake for what lunatic terrors may come. The night is full of awful sounds, and yet I feel the urge to go again, to watch, to see. It seems that Philip calls me, and the old man. The birds. Cursed, cursed, cursed. Yet you must notice, Bones, near the conclusion, that he claims Philip seemed to call him. My final conclusion is formed by these lines, by the talk of Mrs. Cloris and the others, but most of all by these terrifying figures in the cellar, dead yet alive. Our line is yet an unfortunate one, Bones. There is a curse over us which refuses to be buried, and it lives a hideous shadow life in this house and that town, and the culmination of the cycle is drawing close again. I am the last of the Boone blood. I fear that something knows this, and that I am at the nexus of an evil endeavour beyond all sane understanding. The anniversary is All Saints' Eve, 1 week from today. How shall I proceed? If only you were here to counsel me, to help me. If only you were here. I must know all. I must return to the shunned town. May God support me. Charles. From the pocket of Calvin McCann. 25th of October, 1850. Mr. Boone has slept nearly all this day. His face is pallid and much thinner. I fear recurrence of his fever is inevitable. While refreshing his water carafe, I caught sight of two unmailed letters to Mr. Granson in Florida. He plans to return to Jerusalem's lot. 'Twill be the killing of him if I allow it. Dare I steal away to preacher's corners and hire a buggy? I must, and yet what if he wakes? If I should return, find him gone. The noises have begun in our walls again. Thank God he still sleeps. My mind shudders from the import of this. Later. I brought him his dinner on a tray. He plans on rising later, and despite his evasions, I know what he plans. Yet I go to preacher's corners. Several of the sleeping powders prescribed to him during his late illness remained with my things. He drank one with his tea, all unknowing. He sleeps again. To leave him with the things that shamble behind our walls terrifies me. To let him continue even one more day within these walls terrifies me even more greatly. I have locked him in. God grant he should still be there, safe and sleeping, when I return with the buggy. Still later. Stoned me. Stoned me like a wild and rabid dog. Monsters and fiends. These that call themselves men. We are prisoners here. The birds, the whippoorwills, have begun to gather. 26th of October, 1850. It is nearly dusk, and I have just wakened, having slept nearly the last 24 hours away. Although Cal has said nothing, I suspect he put a sleeping powder in my tea, having gleaned my intentions. He is a good and faithful friend, intending only the best, and I shall say nothing. Yet my mind is set. Tomorrow is the day. I am calm, resolved, but also seem to feel the subtle onset of the fever again. If it is so, it must be tomorrow. Perhaps tonight would be better still, yet not even the fires of hell itself could induce me to set foot in that village by shadow light. Should I write no more, may God bless you and keep you, Bones. Charles. Postscriptum. The birds have set up their cry, and the horrible shuffling sounds have begun again. Cal does not think I hear, but I do. From the Journal of Calvin McCann. 27 October, 1850. He is impersuadable. Very well. I go with him. 4th of November, 1850. Dear Bones, weak yet lucid. I am not sure of the date, yet my almanac assures me by tide and sunset that it must be correct. I sit at my desk, where I sat when I first wrote you from Chapelwaite, and look out over the dark sea from which the last of the light is rapidly fading. I shall never see more. This night is my night. I leave it for whatever shadows be. How it heaves itself at the rocks, this sea! It throws clouds of sea foam at the darkling sky and banners, making the floor beneath me tremble. In the window glass I see my reflection, pallid as any vampire's. I have been without nourishment since the 27th of October, and should have been without water had not Calvin left the carafe beside my bed on that day. Oh, Cal, he is no more, Bones. He is gone in my place. In the place of this wretch with his pipe-stem arms and a skull face who I see reflected back in the darkened glass. And yet he may be the more fortunate, for no dreams haunt him as they have haunted me these last days. Twisted shapes that lurk in the nightmare corridors of delirium. Even now my hands tremble. I have splotched the page with ink. Calvin confronted me on that morning, just as I was about to slip away, and I thinking I had been so crafty. I told him that I had decided we must leave, and asked him if he would go to Tandrill, some 10 miles distant, to hire a trap where we were less notorious. He agreed to make the hike, and I watched him leave by the sea road. When he was out of sight, I quickly made myself ready, donning both coat and muffler, for the weather had turned frosty. The first touch of coming winter was on that morning's cutting breeze. I wished briefly for a gun, and then laughed at myself for that wish. What avails guns in such a matter? I let myself out by the pantryway, pausing for a last look at sea and sky, for the smell of fresh air against the putrescence I knew I should smell soon enough, for the sight of a foraging gull wheeling below the clouds. I turned, and there stood Calvin McCann. "You shall not go alone," said he, and his face was as grim as I have ever seen it. "But Calvin," I began. "No, not a word. We go together and do what we must, or I return you bodily to the house. You are not well. You shall not go alone." It is impossible to describe the conflicting emotions that swept over me. Confusion, pique, gratefulness, yet the greatest of them was love. We made our way silently past the summer house and the sundial, down the weed-covered verge and into the woods. All was dead still. Not a bird sang, nor a wood cricket chirruped. The world seemed cupped in a silent pall. There was only the ever-present smell of salt from far away, the faint tang of wood smoke. The woods were a blazoned riot of colour, but, to my eye, scarlet seemed to predominate all. Soon the scent of salt passed, and another more sinister odour took its place. That rottenness which I have mentioned. When we came to the leaning bridge which spanned the Royal, I expected Cal to ask me again to defer, but he did not. He paused, looked at that grim spire which seemed to mock the blue sky above it, and then looked at me. We went on. We proceeded with quick yet dread footsteps to James Boone's church. The door still hung ajar from our latter exit, and the darkness within seemed to leer at us. As we mounted the steps, brass seemed to fill my heart. My hand trembled as it touched the door handle and pulled it. The smell within was greater, more noxious than ever. We stepped into the shadowy anteroom, and, with no pause, into the main chamber. It was a shambles. Something vast had been at work in there, and a mighty destruction had taken place. pews were overturned and heaped like jack straws. The wicked cross lay against the east wall, and a jagged hole in the plaster above it testified to the force with which it had been hurled. The oil lamps had been ripped from their high fixtures, and the reek of whale oil with the terrible stink which pervaded the town. And down the centre aisle, like a ghastly bridal path, was a trail of black ichor mingled with sinister tendrils of blood. Our eyes followed it to the pulpit, the only untouched thing in view. Atop it, staring at us from across that blasphemous book with glazed eyes, was the butchered body of a lamb. God, Calvin whispered. We approached, keeping clear of the slime on the floor. The room echoed back our footsteps and seemed to transmute them into the sound of gigantic laughter. We mounted the narthex together. The lamb had not been torn or eaten. It appeared, rather, to have been squeezed until its blood vessels had forcibly ruptured. Blood lay in thick and noisome puddles on the lectern itself, and about the base of it. Yet on the book it was transparent, and the crabbed runes could be read through as through coloured glass. Must we touch it? Cal asked, unfaltering. Yes, I must have it. What will you do? What should have been done 60 years ago? I'm going to destroy it. We rolled the lamb's corpse away from the book. It struck the floor with a hideous, lolling thud. The blood-stained pages now seemed alive with a scarlet glow of their own. My ears began to ring and hum. A low chant seemed to emanate from the walls themselves. From the twisted look on Cal's face, I knew he heard the same. The floor beneath us trembled, as if the familiar which haunted this church now came to us to protect its own. The fabric of sane space and time seemed to twist and crack. The church seemed filled with spectres and litten with the hell glow of eternal cold fire. It seemed that I saw James Boone, hideous and misshapen, cavorting around the supine body of a woman, and my granduncle Philip behind him, an acolyte in a black hooded cassock, who held a knife and a bowl. Deum vobiscum magna vermis. The words shuddered and writhed on the page before me, soaked in the blood of sacrifice, prize of a creature that shambles beyond the stars. A blind, interbred congregation swaying in mindless demonic praise, deformed faces filled with hungering, nameless anticipation. And the Latin was replaced by an older tongue, ancient when Egypt was young and the pyramids unbuilt, ancient when this earth still hung in an unformed, boiling firmament of empty gas. Giagin vardar yog sothoth, verminis, giagin, giagin, giagin. The pulpit began to rend and split, pushing upwards. Calvin screamed and lifted an arm to shield his face. The narthex trembled with a huge, tenebrous motion like a ship racked in a gale. I snatched up the book and held it away from me. It seemed filled with the heat of the sun, and I felt that I should be cindered, blinded. Run! Calvin screamed. Run! But I stood frozen, and the alien presence filled me like an ancient vessel that had waited for years, for generations. Giagin Vardar! I screamed. Servant of Yog-Sothoth, the Nameless One. The worm from beyond space, star-eater, blinder of time, verminis, now comes the hour of filling, the time of rending, verminis, alia, alia, giagin. Calvin pushed me and I tottered, the church whirling before me, and fell to the floor. My head crashed against the edge of an upturned pew, and red fire filled my head, yet seemed to clear it. I groped for the sulphur matches I had brought. Subterranean thunder filled the place. Plaster fell. The rusted bell in the steeple pealed, choked, devil's carillon in sympathetic vibration. My match flared. I touched it to the book just as the pulpit exploded upwards in a rending explosion of wood. A huge black maw was discovered beneath. Cal tottered on the edge, his hands out, his face distended in a wordless scream that I shall hear forever. And then there came a huge surge of grey, vibrating flesh. The smell became a nightmare tide. It was a huge outpouring of a viscid, pustulent jelly, a huge and awful form that seemed to skyrocket from the very bowels of the ground. And yet, with a sudden horrible comprehension which no man can have known, I perceived that it was but one ring, one segment of a monster worm that had existed eyeless for years in the chambered darkness beneath that abominated church. The book flared alight in my hands, and the thing seemed to scream soundlessly above me. Calvin was struck glancingly and flung the length of the church like a doll with a broken neck. The thing subsided, leaving only a huge and shattered hole surrounded with black slime and a great screaming mewling sound that seemed to fade through colossal distances and was gone. I looked down. The book was ashes. I began to laugh, then to howl like a struck beast. All sanity left me, and I sat on the floor with blood streaming from my temple, screaming and gibbering into those unhallowed shadows, while Calvin sprawled in the far corner, staring at me with glazing, horror-struck eyes. I have no idea how long I existed in that state. It is beyond all telling. But when I came again to my faculties, shadows had drawn long paths around me, and I sat in twilight. Movement had caught my eye, movement from the shattered hole in the narthex floor. A hand groped its way over the riven floorboards. My mad laughter choked in my throat, all hysteria melted into numb bloodlessness. With terrible, vengeful slowness, a racked figure pulled itself up from darkness, and a half-skull peered at me. Beetles crawled over the fleshless forehead, a rotted cassock clung to the askew hollows of moulded collarbones. Only the eyes lived. Red, insane pits that glared at me with more than lunacy. They glared with the empty life of the pathless wastes beyond the edges of the universe. It came to take me down to darkness. That was when I fled, screeching, leaving the body of my lifelong friend unheeded in that place of dread. I ran until the air seemed to burst like magma in my lungs and brain. I ran until I had gained this possessed and tainted house again, and my room where I collapsed and have lain like a dead man until today. I ran because even in my crazed state, and even in the shattered ruin of that dead yet animated shape, I had seen the family resemblance. Yet not of Philip or of Robert, whose likenesses hang in the upstairs gallery. That rotted visage belonged to James Boone, Keeper of the Worm. He still lives, somewhere in the twisted, lightless wanderings beneath Jerusalem's lot and chapel weight, and it still lives. The burning of the book thwarted it, but there are other copies. Yet I am the gateway. I am the last of the Boone blood. For the good of all humanity, I must die, and break the chain forever. I go to the sea now, Bones. My journey, like my story, is at an end. May God rest you and grant you peace. The odd series of papers above was eventually received by Mr. Everett Granson, to whom they had been addressed. It is assumed that a recurrence of the unfortunate brain fever which struck him originally following the death of his wife in 1848 caused Charles Boone to lose his sanity and murder his companion and longtime friend, Mr. Calvin McCann. The entries in Mr. McCann's pocket journal are a fascinating exercise in forgery, undoubtedly perpetrated by Charles Boone in an effort to reinforce his own paranoid delusions. In at least two particulars, Charles Boone is proved wrong. First, when the town of Jerusalem's lot was rediscovered, I use the term historically, of course, the floor of the narthex, although rotted, showed no sign of the explosion or huge damage. Although the ancient pews were overturned and several windows shattered, this can be assumed to be the work of vandals from neighbouring towns over the years. Among the older residents of Preacher's Corners and Trandall, there is still some idle rumour about Jerusalem's lot. Perhaps in his day it was this kind of harmless folk legend which started Charles Boone's mind on its fatal course. But this seems hardly relevant. Second, Charles Boone was not the last of his line. His grandfather, Robert Boone, sired at least two bastards. One died in infancy. The second took the Boone name and located in the town of Central Falls, Rhode Island. I am the final descendant of this offshoot of the Boone line, Charles Boone's second cousin removed by three generations. These papers have been in my committal for 10 years. I offer them for publication on the occasion of my residence in the Boone ancestral home, Chapelwaite, in the hope that the reader will find sympathy in his heart for Charles Boone's poor, misguided soul. So far as I can tell, he was correct about only one thing. This place badly needs the services of an exterminator. There are some huge rats in the walls by the sound. Signed, James Robert Boone, the 2nd of October, 1971. You see how weird and spooky things get? I love it. I love the sort of gentle but still surprisingly harsh upturn with which things get weird and spooky. I like that there's lots of things I like about the sort of implicit storytelling in this book, about how the mere existence of certain things in Jerusalem's lot, the town, you just know they're horrible. Things like the mouldering leather in the shop, and things like they're just the way that the flesh of the worm is described. It's just so disgusting, to be completely honest with you. And I kind of love that style of writing. I mean, you know, I don't enjoy reading those words and going, oh yeah, that sounds good, but like, I enjoy how it makes me feel unsettled. I really like how this story deals with the sort of horror-terror dichotomy of, I think it was the sort of, I forget who, it was one of the Gothic writers, Mary Shelley, and some of her mates came up with a sort of a distinction between horror and terror, and I think I'm getting this right. Horror is what you feel when something horrendous is about to happen to you, and terror is what you feel in the moment when the horrendous thing is happening and you're running away from a terrifying giant flesh worm or whatever it might be. You see the horror of this, the events that happen in the book. You see them coming. You know this person's going to Salem's Lot and it's going to go badly for them. You know that Charles is going to go and he's going to get brutally killed or something awful will happen, and then it happens and you go, oh yeah, could have seen that coming. I think that that is brilliant because, again, it just makes you inherently unsettled. And how much better sort of horror, the soon-to-come sort of horribleness, how much better horror could you get than sort of the entire story being proved correct? In the final words, when the sort of descendant goes and lives in the house that he's sort of ancestrally inherited somehow, he said, yeah, there are some bloody big rats in this house. I like that it's accidental, the proving right sort of aspect of it. This is it's sort of part of a, it's part of part of Salem's Lot, the book, is the implication that the town itself is just sort of a shitty place. Like, horrible things keep happening there over generations, and nobody really can tell why. People come and go, and horrible things seem to keep happening no matter who's there. And this, I first read this story as the epilogue to Salem's Lot, and that was the context in which I took it. And I thought, okay, well, it must be that there's a big old fucking horrible worm living underneath Salem's Lot, and that's why horrible things keep happening there. And while that's... it's not quite as horrific as some of the other implications of Salem's Lot, which is a thing for another day. It is certainly horrific. The idea that it's this cosmic horror idea of there are unknowable things beyond the edge of our universe. They speak in languages which we can't know, and they do things for reasons we can't possibly hope to define. That cosmic horror, which snaps so beautifully into this sort of corrupted church in the village. Because it's sort of like the way that God is described in at least in my experience, as this figure that's sort of ominously positive, always there, always wishing you well, always loving you, and always there to help you. If you just sort of invert that, it's a creature that's always there, always trying to harm you, always trying to wish you misfortune, and always trying to corrupt your sort of soul. It's the same thing. So you can see the sort of, you can't see the logic because it's absurd, but you can see why the original Boone started that sort of horrific church in which he worshipped these beings. And that cosmic horror aspect, I think, makes the entire story much more contextually terrifying. This is just a little, very brief thing that I think I want to bring up, because it's something that Stephen King does really well. Uneasy topics lead to great horror, I think. You see it quite often. Stephen King uses sex in this sort of context. In this book, he used it as sort of this 100-year-old man is having sex with all these random women in this village, and that's something that you go, oh, that's a bit weird, and that opens the door and for Stephen King to jam his foot in the jamb of the door, for him to tell you all about these horrific things that are happening in this village. I think slightly, vaguely unsettling things, like a sex scene in the middle of, that comes out of the middle of nowhere, it makes you go, oh God, I wasn't expecting that. And it's a shock, but it's sort of a shock that's not as bad as a horrific jump scare where Pennywise jumps around a corner or something. Instead, it's just a jump scare and you go, oh, okay, yeah, I know what this is. And then that thing that you think you know what it is, the village or the people or in Salem's Lot, the townsfolk, it becomes corrupted over time. And I think that uneasy topic, things that people wouldn't want to just chat about in day-to-day life, it's a slightly uneasy topic that I think, if broached correctly and if used correctly, it's a brilliant tool to leverage stupendously terrifying horror. Okay, that is the end of my reading of Jerusalem's Lot, the short story, and of my brief adoration of the story. If you don't mind, and even if you do mind, I'm going to do a cheeky bit of shilling now, as we tend to do at the end of these podcasts. The podcast has a wide variety of link trees throughout which you can find our social media, our Patreon, our merch store, all sorts of things. You go to linktr.ee/ for me, Lewis_Brindley. For Danny, it's O'Hiram. And for the podcast, it's Shouting Into the Void. You go there and you'll find links to everything you could possibly want to know, to our YouTube channel, all the places where you can find our podcast, to our merch store, our Patreon, all of it. Speaking of our merch, we have some great merch. We sell some fantastic merch on both Teespring and Redbubble, and to be quite honest, we really like all the stuff that we sell. My personal favourite is the tote bag, which I think I mentioned in Friday's episode. This bag contains precisely 10 minutes of bullshit. I like it. It's a good bag. If you want to go and treat yourself, go for it. I would highly recommend it. We have in the house, my house, I was just gesturing around me. In my house, we have one of the Void hoodies and one of the Void t-shirts. They're both good. I like them. They're good. We wear them sometimes. And if you wanted to support us, but you didn't want any of our merch, you can go and check out our Patreon at patreon.com/shoutingintothevoid. And you can sign up for as little as, I think it's about 20p per episode or even less. And you'll be supporting us and you'll be enabling us to do what we love to do, which is this show. And thank you very much to every single one of our patrons that is supporting us on Patreon at the moment. It means the absolute world. If you choose to go and sign up with our Patreon, you can get access to patron-only bits of the Discord server, you can suggest things for us to do or talk about, you can get your opinion heard on different films and stuff that we review, so go and check it out. So we've got some really great perks over there, and it would mean the world if you could help us out, so thank you very much. That is everything. Next week, we'll be back to our regularly scheduled programming, where I think, of all things, we are talking about Family Guy. So look forward to that. I know I'm looking forward to it. And have a lovely afternoon, or evening, or morning, or whatever. Okay, thank you for listening.